It starts, in my experience at least, with just the faintest whisper that something isn't right. There's a tiny rumble in your stomach, a few drops of sweat on your brow. Give it a few hours though, and that whisper has turned into a scream. You're sick. It's food poisoning. It's a tropical disease. It's some crazy virus you've never even heard of before. Travel is amazing, but it also, unfortunately, exposes you to a whole range of new ways to get sick. A whole gamut of fantastic, exotic ways to pick up the lurgy. Some of these illnesses can be pretty minor, but some of them can ruin your entire holiday. Hi, I'm Ben Groundwater, and you're listening to Flight of Fancy, the traveller.com.au podcast. Today we're talking about getting sick when you're travelling. How does it happen? Where does it happen? And what do you do when you're at your worst? Before we get into today's chat, though, I should mention that there are two lawyers currently standing over me telling me that I should mention that the advice that we give today is general in nature, and you should really seek advice from a health professional before making any decisions on your travels. Joining me to discuss this today, I have two traveller.com.au writers who have been hit with the lurgy plenty of times. The first is a travel writer and adventurer who once thought it was a good idea to eat nothing but bread and cheese for 10 days, Flip Byrne.
I'm already in trouble. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Flip. Also joining us is traveller.com.au's tripologist, the font of all travel knowledge, who, it turns out, is not immune to a case of deli belly, Michael Gebicki.
Hi, Ben.
Hi, Michael. Great to have you guys around. Now, Michael, let's talk about this deli belly thing. Mm. You know, there's Bali belly, there's Pharaoh's revenge, there's Montezuma's revenge. Is this an actual thing that people have to worry about?
Oh, yeah, it is. I mean, it goes by various names, but it's basically the same thing. And look, I think it comes about because you when you travel, you're being exposed to a whole different biomass, a whole different mass of microbes that you don't normally encounter in your everyday life.
Right.
And a lot of local people build up defenses against this sort of stuff. You know, they're exposed to it from a very young age. Mm-hmm. So I have a theory that their guts are configured in a different way to ours.
Right.
Okay. So
it's often a bacterial thing, isn't it? You develop things to fight off certain.
It is. So it's just simply that you're out of your regular environment. You're somewhere else. And usually, you know, something, it can be waterborne. That's a classic way to get it. But, food as well, obviously.
Yeah.
Anything you put in your mouth.
And apparently airborne as well, because Flip, didn't you get quite sick in India just from breathing?
I did, yes. People ask me how I got sick in India, and I just have to tell them I was there.
Right.
That's
right.
Pretty much, like, it could have been absolutely anything. And I got cholera at the time, right. So I didn't know.
Of course you did.
Of course I did. Went straight for the big one. Mm-hmm. But, you know, my dad's a gastroenterologist, so he deals a lot with gut kind of problems.
Yeah.
And it did strike me after a day or so that I should probably give him a call. Mm-hmm. And he's a very relaxed kind of guy. And I said, look, there's this really strange thing. Won't give you guys too much detail, but there's just a lot of water coming out of all places where water kind of shouldn't be coming out. So I did say to him,
that's the not too much detail.
That's the not too much detail. And Dad goes, you know, I think that sounds like cholera. He goes, that's interesting. You shouldn't be able to get that there anymore. So he had someone bring back a test tube of water from the Ganges, and there was stuff in there that they'd never seen before. And he said he regularly gets people coming back from India. And, you know, it's a real cause for not celebration, but real interest among the doctors when they go, look, here's another thing. None of us have seen it. What could it be? You know, and they might never see it again. It's just a magical, magical land of microbes.
Right. I mean, yeah. India is one of those ones that always comes up in a conversation like that, isn't it? Although it's a fantastic travel destination, it always seems to make people sick as well.
India is the acid test. I think if you know, it's legendary in the annals of sickness and travelers' illnesses. If you survive India, nothing can touch you. You're good. You're
I must say, I've been to India a couple of times and I haven't been sort of properly sick there. I have gone onto a vegetarian diet, which I've found is good because, one, vegetarian food is amazing in India. And also, you know, the sort of handling of meat is maybe not what we would be used to in Australia. And that sort of stood me in good stead. I was a little bit surprised by not being struck down.
Sure, but even when you are trying to be the savvy traveller, and because we've got the tripologist here, it's a little bit intimidating, isn't it,
It is,
Ben?
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah, because he knows a lot about a lot. And the problem is that, you know, I bought a bottled water, you know, never drink something unless it's been sealed, and it was perfectly sealed, cracked it open. But as I was drinking it, I realised in this bottle of water, I could see at the bottom dirt and grit and a couple of rocks. I'm like, that's an interesting sealed bottle of water.
Have you seen, there's a scene in Slumdog Millionaire where they're all at, they're at a restaurant in the back, you know, filling up water bottles from the tap and then sealing them with a lighter.
And I was already a bit traumatised by India at this point, and my friend just said, look away, Flip, look away. Don't look at the rocks, just drink it.
Well, here's a good tip. You should always go for fizzy water. If you're unsure of the water quality, drink carbonated water, because they can't, they can fake the bottle
the seal. Yeah.
They can't fake those little bubbles when you open it.
That's very true.
If it goes, psh,
I don't know. I think that was 2016, the reseal. 2017. Who knows?
Maybe.
Who knows what they're up to?
I have this completely unscientific theory of drinking Coca-Cola or, you know, fizzy drinks like that. While I'm traveling through countries, I'm a little bit worried about, because I figure all of the things in that drink is just going to strip all of the dodgy bacteria away.
I'm behind you on that one. It's worked fairly well for me. Yeah.
And it's also, you know, it's reliably clean.
Yeah,
what you're drinking.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, if you want to go down the Coke path, Pepsi path, Fanta, whatever.
Yeah,
Limca in India.
Yeah. Sure. Unless you lick the top.
Oh yeah.
Don't go licking the can.
I've never felt the need to do that.
I'm just saying don't do it. Don't do it in India.
Good advice. Yeah. Right. I mean, we should give India a little bit of a break here, because it's not just India that this stuff happens, is it?
Like, no.
I mean, probably the sickest I've ever been overseas was actually in Peru. Where I picked up some sort of odd, I'm not sure if it was foodborne or waterborne or what, but I basically spent about 3 days, you know, curled up in the fetal position in a hotel, sweating and in a fever. I really should have gone to hospital, but I'm a man, so I make stupid decisions like that and just don't.
A man with a beard.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, it was horrendous. But nobody else I knew got sick in Peru at all. Sometimes you're just unlucky, I think.
It is unlucky, yeah.
I mean, Flippy, you got extremely sick in France, am I right? Who gets sick in France?
I get sick in France. No, that's right. Okay, so basically I was doing the Tour de Mont Blanc, which is a 10-day hike, and I didn't realise until I got back to Chamonix that I hadn't been to the bathroom for 10 days. And that might have had something to do with the fact that I was just eating the local produce, which was bread and cheese. But when I got to the hospital, which is where I ended up, and they said to me, what have you been eating? And I said, bread and cheese. And they went, well, what about for breakfast? And I was like, no, this was a continual everyday, like, breakfast, because it was so good, different cheeses. Like, don't
of
get
course.
Me wrong.
Oh,
I was mixing up the brie with the camembert, with
you're
the vacheron.
Yeah.
No. I had some.
That was a varied diet, I'd say.
Yeah, it was very. Thank you, Michael. I knew that you'd see the point.
So did you have scurvy in the end of that or what?
No, because I tossed in the odd tomato if it was a special treat kind of day. Mm-hmm. And it was that quite easily fixed in the end. But the moral to that story was, like, you know, go for the local produce, but just probably not the same one. Repetitively.
Yeah, and some vegetables.
Good advice.
Yeah, and they were not, I don't think they thought I was an idiot, but it was imparted that I might have been a little bit stupid. Like when I said I've just eaten 30 meals of bread and cheese.
People always say when you go to France, like, oh, you know, you can spend a lot of money on food if you want, or you can just live on bread and cheese.
Well, I did, and it didn't work out. And so, but yeah, when I tabulated, it was 30 meals of bread and cheese consecutively. And they looked at me and
were
just like,
where are you getting the fresh bread from?
Oh, up in the refuges. No, they get some. They helicopter food in, fresh food up there. The French
that is the most French thing I've ever heard. They airlift in baguettes.
In there. Look, you can sleep in dorms, but you can't have stale bread. It's
I mean, because those things are a baseball bat after 12 hours or so.
And then what would happen if you had a riot with baseball bat, stale bread? So, yeah, moral to story, got to have fresh bread. But also, you'll end up with serious consequences after 30 consecutive bread cheese meals.
Good advice.
I live to tell the tale. That's all I can say.
Michael, do you think extensive travel, does it end up giving you a cast iron stomach, or does it make you more susceptible?
I think it does. I have a theory that once you've had a bout of something terrible happen to you, like you in Peru, for example, I think it won't happen to you again. This is my hope that I cling to anyway.
Right.
Like, I remember the first time I've been to India, getting up to 15 times now. And the first time I was there, I was catastrophically ill. We got to Delhi and, you know, it was one of those cases you don't know which end to hang over the toilet. It's explosive.
I'm glad we're amongst friends.
But, you know, after that, I've never got sick in India. I've got sick in other places.
Really?
I've got sick in Bhutan, places like that, where you wouldn't expect to. I think it does give you a certain immunity.
I've not found that. I found I get sicker and sicker as I'm traveling around. I was in Uganda once and I had been traveling in Africa for quite a while, and I'd started to believe that I was developing a cast iron stomach. And I was chatting to the guide that we had, and he was drinking tap water. And he said, you know, the tap water is actually not that bad here. And I was like, well, sure, let's do it. I'm pretty tough. And so I drank the tap water. Yeah, I was horrendously ill for about 24 hours or so after that. Yeah, well, that was a really bad decision.
Just because it's somebody, it's okay for a local to do it.
Yeah,
doesn't necessarily mean it's okay for you to do it.
Yeah. I have a friend who swears by having a spoonful of local water when they arrive in a destination, thinking that they might get temporarily a little bit sick, but they'll stand them in good stead for the rest of their trip. What do you think about that?
It could be if it works for them.
Like a live vaccine kind of.
I don't know that it's good medical advice. I have no qualms, I must say, about I have no qualms about cleaning my teeth in tap water in India. I don't swallow it.
Okay. That's controversial.
I won't swallow it, but I'll do it. it could. Well, people have weird theories. You know, people have theories about if you eat lots of garlic, it'll help you keep mosquitoes away, and therefore you won't get malaria or chikungunya or something like that.
Garlic Coke, I think would have a lot of country covered.
So. Yeah.
Or you might be onto something. Rub it on your skin, that'd be even, you know, roll even around better. You.
What are the classic ailments that people tend to pick up when they're traveling? Is it all sort of stomach viruses?
Pretty much. Yeah. You know, one of the simplest things you can do is wash your hands before you eat, before you put them in your mouth. And that applies to the stuff you're eating on the plane as well. Just, you know, before you put anything in your mouth, have clean hands. It lowers the rate of transmission of all these things you don't want to get.
You're a big fan of the hand sanitizer, aren't you?
Massive fan of the hand sanitizer. Yeah, I agree with Michael on this one. Mm-hmm. I've always got a little hand sanitizer in my luggage or in my pocket and, always have that a few times a day. And, I think it's a really good barrier. Yes, and then I drink it, and then I bathe in it. it does work, I think. Yeah. And I'm just interested to know, Michael, because you've been 15 times to India, and then you didn't get sick again. Is there anything that you began doing after? And look, India, we can't trash it because it's a magnificent, magical. Amazing. It's worth it. It's worth the risk of cholera.
Oh, absolutely.
But is there anything you started doing differently? You know, after
that
your
time
first
trip, I was really traveling on the cheap. Yeah.
Right.
So I think if you travel on the cheap, you're much more susceptible to the kind of diseases that are around. Mm. You know, I mean, all this, if you travel in, you know, reasonably salubrious surroundings, if you travel, you know, you're staying in good quality hotels, you're probably eating reasonable quality food, all that kind of stuff. These are kind of the basic things that will give you that, a kind of a shell, I think, protection.
I think that's really good advice, but you also kind of miss out on a little bit of the experience by doing that.
Oh, Ben, you're a backpacker. Oh, it just comes out, doesn't it?
A recent trip I had to Sri Lanka, where I was staying not by choice in some fairly fancy hotels, and eating at these sort of 5-star hotels.
I was eating it.
I mean, when you're staying at these places, often they're in the middle of nowhere, so you have no choice for the night. And so I was eating these sort of hotel buffets where they've got, you know, roast chicken and pasta Alfredo and stuff like that. And I never got sick from any of that, but I craved the places that I was going to for lunch, which were these sort of dodgy mum and dad kind of restaurants where you'd go in there and they had a whole lot of clay bowls of different curries.
Spices and
that had been sort of left out for most of the afternoon. There were flies buzzing around and you would just sort of, and there's rice sitting there. Rice for people who, you know, are sort of early travelers. Rice is a conduit for bacteria. There's rice goes horrible very, very quickly. So you need to be very careful with that. But basically, you'd walk along, pile up a whole lot of rice and a whole lot of curries on your plate. It would cost about $1.50, and you sit there and eat it with your hands. So you have to really wash your hands properly before you eat. And you know, you're kind of looking around, thinking, "Oh, this is going to do terrible things to me." But it tasted so good, and it's such a great experience to kind of sit around with the people in that place, and you know, everyone staring at you like, "What is that guy doing with his hands? Why is he smushing food all over his face like that?" One person said to me, "Is there a problem with your fingers? Are they broken or something?" I was like, "No, I just have no idea how to feed myself with my hands."
So you have no qualms about eating food that's been left out? Because I do.
I have qualms, but I put them aside because I really enjoy the experience of being there.
Street food is great. It's one of the pleasures of traveling, but especially in the third world. But I have real hesitation about eating food that looks as though it's been sitting around. If flies have been getting on it, if it's cooked in front of me, like they in Thailand, which is the typical all over Southeast Asia, absolutely no problem.
Yeah,
no problem with anything, eating any of that stuff.
I should point out, I'm no tough guy traveler. I get sick a lot, and it could be because I just do things like this. But I do feel there's those sort of golden rules that travel doctors will always tell you that if you can't peel it, cook it, or boil it, then you shouldn't eat it. And that is, those are excellent sort of rules to go by, but they also mean that you miss out on a lot of experiences that are perhaps
like being really, really ill.
Yeah, and visiting the local hospital and finding out how corrupt their system is.
I mean, also ice. People tell you
I'm really sick in Tamil.
Never to drink ice. Never have ice in your drink. But you're missing out on those amazing sort of shakes that you get in Thailand, or you're missing out on, a decent rum and coke at a bar somewhere, or... I break those rules frequently. And
in those situations, I think your hand sanitizer before you smash the food all over your face just isn't going to save you.
Probably
you might as well pat the dog, and then go for the ride.
You might as well lick the dog.
Seriously. Not even a garlic Coca-Cola is going to save you in that instance, I don't think.
Do you, Flip, do you have golden rules when you're traveling? What will you, things you won't eat or, rituals?
Yeah, I'm with Michael. I pretty much, because I do a lot of solo traveling as well, solo female traveling. So that's a whole another kettle of fish, hopefully not left in the sun. Because you don't want to get sick.
Freshly boiled.
And seafood is bad.
Well, in Asia, you will not catch me eating. And I know that it's a shame because they've got great seafood and cheap and people love it. You won't catch me eating seafood because... have a look sometimes at the people around you, and if they're, not looking tippy-top, walk into their kitchens and have a look at what's happening in there, and if there's a black house...
How does one judge who's tippy-top and not who's not?
I don't know, actually. That's a really good question.
Intuition, I suppose.
Yeah, intuition. Yeah. And, if there's a blackout on your little Thai island for 4 hours, maybe don't go to the lobster.
Right. So
little things like that that you don't think about because, if you get laid low and you're a solo traveller, it's quite a serious thing. So hand sanitizer, and I'm also with Michael on the street food cooked by a hot wok. Nothing safer in my mind than a 100-degree piping hot spitting oil wok.
Yeah. That's one of the interesting things. People are sort of frightened of street food a little bit, but if you're standing there watching something cooked fresh and hot, it's generally going to be okay.
And then sometimes those higher-end hotels that have little turnover in developing countries and those buffets sitting there for a couple of hours, they can cause a lot more problems then.
Mm. I've heard one of the worst things you can do is order a club sandwich from room service.
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Apparently that's I don't know where I read this.
Actually, on that, I was going to say, I think a very important thing to do to remain healthy is to eat local food, is to eat things that local people eat all the time because it's a much higher turnover.
Yep.
Of that sort of food, and people know how to handle it. They know how to cook it properly. If you're going to try and stick to Western foods that aren't, the dumb thing there.
Yes.
I traveled around Laos with a English mate of mine who's really not very adventurous with food at all. And the rest of us were sort of going into these dodgy looking noodle soup shops with, dirt floors and eating mystery meat. And he was running around trying to find ham sandwiches everywhere. Mm. And he was constantly sick.
Yeah.
And the rest of us were fine.
Is that your club sandwich?
Yeah,
story,
more or less. That dovetails with that, sure, because it's not – apparently chicken is notoriously, it's
difficult.
Notoriously bad. If it's bad, it's really bad.
Yeah.
It's apparently it's one you should stay away from probably.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, what about going to the travel doctor before you go away somewhere? Is that something that you do, Michael?
Look, I don't. I should probably, but – I'm pretty bad about that.
Advising everyone on their shots.
There's what I do and what I advise people to do, and unfortunately they don't always mesh.
Do as I say, not as I do.
Yeah, look, the advice that the travel doctors will give you, they're really great. They're specialist people. Mm-hmm. They will try and cover all the bases for you. They'll try and make sure. But often I'm in a place for a very short time. Mm. I'm traveling in reasonable comfort, pretty good conditions.
Yeah.
And therefore, I'm probably not going to get cholera or typhoid or – I mean, these are diseases that come with traveling, in really poor countries. And I think for quite a while when your resistance maybe starts to run down a bit, they're not everywhere around you, So I tend to be a little bit wary of the kind of I don't do everything that they say. I don't even take malaria pills, and that's kind of. But I will try and make sure that I don't get bitten in the first place.
Yeah.
See, I'm more of a jab me.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
Just give
jab
me everything
me.
You've got.
Yep. Lay it out on the table one by one.
Yeah.
Serve it up. Yeah. I know. Is that? Are you adverse, Michael, to you know some of the reactions that you have from, or you just think it's unnecessary to put those into your system, or what's your?
I'd feelings? Rather medicate as little as possible.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just try and stay away from it.
Sure.
I mean, so there's some places you have to have, you know, yellow fever for certain parts of Africa. You won't get back into Australia.
Some things are good to have just in general, you know, the hepatitis shots.
Tetanus. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Tetanus,
and I do that. I keep
we're
up to date with that.
We're not anti-vaxxers.
No. Not at all.
No.
I do have that. And that's always
I think the good thing also is that, like, some of these last for so long. You know, some of these, you know, shots will last for 10 years and stuff. So I kind of forget. But I guess if I had to go and line up again for them right now, I might, like yourself, just choose wisely which ones I need. Ask me in a couple of years.
There's a really good website. I often go to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control website.
Okay.
They've got a really comprehensive website with country by country profiles of what the risks are, what you need to watch out for.
I do think it's worth taking that into account.
Absolutely.
As well, because if you go to a travel doctor, they generally will try to fill you up with every single vaccine they have.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, if you kind of do a bit of research and you can make your own decision on how much danger you're in.
The CDC is a really good website, really good resource. They keep it up to date. It's always, you know, it's like the DFAT advice, you know, about the levels of security. It's always there, and it's very sort of cold-blooded but very sensible. I mean, you know what Americans are like. They're pretty paranoid about getting sick and bringing anything back. So it is really a comprehensive analysis of what the risks are and what you maybe should be doing if you're going to stay in those places.
Right.
And then you're right, just trying to avoid it in the first place, you know, with mosquitoes, you know, maybe not wearing a red singlet top. Good idea.
Yeah.
Or you just cover up a bit careful. In the evenings especially and wear some squirt on some repellent.
Yeah.
I'm seeing you right now, Mike. I imagine you in a safari hat with one of those big mosquito veils.
That's exactly me.
You're carrying a mosquito rifle. Yeah. whatever that may be.
Beekeeper's suit.
Yeah, beekeeper's suit.
And biohazard.
You can wear one of those big, space suit things.
Well, apparently I'm just strolling around in shorts and T-shirt.
Are you?
Yeah.
The backpacker.
Yeah, that's right. Can't afford medication.
No.
Now, let's talk about insurance. You guys, I assume, would take out travel insurance every time you go away?
I have just 12-month cover, so, yeah, it just renews.
Yeah.
I know, off the news of the vax, Michael, nothing would surprise me about you anymore.
Flip, you had to call on travel insurance on a number of occasions,
haven't you?
Yes, I
have been. Actually, yes. I guess, like, the more extreme your adventures become, your exposure to risk also accelerates.
Mm-hmm.
So I did a trip to Greenland, which both of you know about.
As one does.
So I had a great-grandfather called Frank Hurley, who was an Antarctic explorer who was going for the South Pole with Shackleton but didn't quite make it at the time.
Yeah.
We have a long history in the Burns family of not getting where we're going. and so to recreate that trip, I had to go and do a training trip in Greenland because that is an ice cap that recreates Antarctica perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
So it started out just as a little trip, just a training trip, but it wasn't
really. So what was the plan? What were you trying to do?
So we're going to do – it was to be an Australian first woman crossing Greenland ice cap, so 800 kilometres. But I didn't even know that. I was literally just training for Antarctica and then it turned out to this big
thing. Just setting a lazy world record along the way.
Yeah, and 60 Minutes got involved and North Face were my sponsor and, it was all really exciting. It got a bit bigger than myself, to be honest. And then, of course, so when it didn't work out.
So what happened?
So we were kite skiing and the winds originate off the middle of Greenland and drop down. So we had to get at least into the middle of the ice cap to get the winds for the kite skiing. So I knew there'd be about 300 kilometres of hauling an 80-kilogram sled.
Wow.
Slightly uphill. Mm-hmm. So I knew that was part of the deal. Yep. And what I didn't do was strap my feet.
Okay.
Properly. And I got a blister on about day 4.
Right.
And then I got a few blisters by about day 6. By about day 13, a couple of hundred kilometres in, my feet were mincemeat and I was so infected. So, one of the guys with us was with the Norwegian Army and he said that, you know, walking your blisters, they heal overnight. And when you start walking again in the ski boots, they'd break. And I could just feel the liquid, but it was warm. It was quite nice. Like warm liquid. And they call it walking your blisters warm in the Norwegian army, should you ever have that as a trivia question. So anyway, what happened was one day I started, too much information, guys, but started urinating blood. I knew that the trip was over for me at that point, but I didn't want to tell anyone because this was my big trip, you know, and I'd been training for a year. I didn't want to get off it.
Yeah.
Eventually, I thought I should probably tell someone because a storm was coming and they said, if you don't get out now, you're not getting out for 3 days. I didn't actually know what was wrong with me. So I said, okay. So we called the chopper and then the big chopper came and this Norwegian guy says, that's odd. It's the big chopper. And then 8 guys in uniform jump out. We haven't seen anyone for 3 weeks. In the middle of the ice cap, we have this, you know, really strange occurrence. So I went, they've come to arrest me for being a loser because I haven't made it.
And my blisters.
My blisters. And it turned out they'd never done a rescue that deep into the ice cap. So they called up all their mates. Hey, guys.
Probably a good little training exercise.
Going into the ice cap. Yeah. So they all came in. And that particular airlift was about
$22,000.
Yes, $22,000.
Would have cost you.
It would have cost me. Luckily, yeah. I had $4,000 of insurance.
Wow.
They don't insure Australians for that type of adventure, except for at a premium. Not my fault, I promise you. It was
partly
only
your
eight,
fault.
No, take that back. $800 or 800 euros for Europeans. Anyone outside the euro area is 4,000,
right.
2,000 pounds, over 2,000 pounds. So I was glad that that got used.
Yeah.
Given
I mean,
my
you did kind of prove them right, though, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. As high-risk Australians. And look, the, you know, getting sick on that one, what was the good bit was that, I'm just so, I was never sad about it. I was so glad that I had gone as far as I'd gone and I just discovered a whole new world and I discovered that I loved it. So
yeah.
Even amongst the misery, it was my place. I'd found my place.
Right.
So.
And you had that backup insurance to get you out of there.
Oh, yeah, and you can't actually do that kind of trip. They won't let you.
Uninsured.
Yeah, they won't let you do that trip uninsured. So, yeah, and then I saw Prince Frederick, obviously, who has done a lot of Greenland stuff at the Beijing Olympics, and we had a chat about Greenland, and I said, look, the insurance is just too much. And he goes, I know, but sometimes we have to pull people out.
but you know,
what
this,
could I say?
This gets around to the point that, that travel, that getting sick when you travel is completely underrated. There's a big upside to it, which is that you get to, you know, you get to have these fantastic stories. Look, let's face it, when you're, you know, you're sitting by the pool in Martinique, sipping a cocktail and you're sending back selfies to your mates, you know, everybody hates you. You know, they don't like you, do they?
It's generally an indication that you've done something interesting if you get sick, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly right. But, you know,
I've got nothing
if you get food poisoning or something really serious off the cocktail olive that you just ingested. And, you know, you destroy your whole holiday, you spend your whole time in bed or, you know, be sick. I mean, that's a much better story. And people will like you for it.
I have some friends who actually got sick on their honeymoon. One of them got very sick on his honeymoon in Thailand.
Good story.
And they were staying at a sort of couples-only resort and he was basically bedridden for 4 days. And she would come down and have breakfast by herself and then go and sit by the pool by herself. And after a while, people sort of came over to her and said,
how's the honeymoon
going? You know, is everything okay? Have you just come over here by yourself? She's like, no, I have a husband. He's just...
See, that's a much better story than a happy honeymoon story, isn't it?
Yeah.
You can dine out on that for months.
We are, but we're really skirting around, I guess, the topic of when things do go bad. Nothing went bad, you know, on that trip. Came back intact. But, you know, when you look at insurance and the serious things of being long-term hospitalised in a foreign country or trying to be repatriated or for your family trying to repatriate a body which you don't want to think about, that stuff runs into tens and tens of thousands of dollars.
Yeah, that's true. So, yeah, there's a very serious element to this.
I
mean, I take sort of dumb risks with food and stuff all the time.
Yeah, yeah, which is what 99% of travel is about. It's about those silly things. But there is that very small margin where, you know.
Yeah. When I was a young backpacker, I broke my collarbone in the US and that would have been an extremely expensive exercise
in the US,
had I not had insurance because it's the US. Medical bills are crazy.
Yeah. I saw a figure the other day. There was figures from the travel insurance industry. They reckon about 1 in 4 Australians that go overseas don't have travel insurance.
Yeah, I talk to a lot of people that don't.
Yeah, people go to Bali without travel insurance. And, you know, the frequency of little accidents happening in Bali is pretty high.
Yeah, that's right.
So, you're in trouble.
Yeah, and it's more than that. It's also just about having that support from Australia. I think the other time I ended up with a big bill was maternity bill in France. I was 6 weeks pregnant. 6 weeks pregnant.
Doesn't happen to me.
With a huge apologist. Yeah, and I ended up, in hospital, and then had to be bedridden for about 3 months it was. And during that time, no one actually knew that I was pregnant except for obviously my partner and some, you know, family, close friends. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't tell anyone where I was. And in that week, it was $1,000 a day, this random, €1,000 a day, in this random small town in France. They didn't want to move me anywhere. And the only person I spoke to was the guy from my travel insurance company who called me every day, every morning, to say, how are you going? How are things? You know, are you having problems communicating with the doctors? That guy still gets a Christmas card from me every year. And it's been 4 years now, just to say, you know, thanks again. And yeah, I don't think they realize the support that they actually give you when you're overseas. And this $1,000 day, so that turned into a $10,000 bill.
Wow.
I'm surprised anyone insures me at this point. Yeah. At this
particularly
point
not after listening to this podcast. Yeah.
But for that €1,000 a day, television was an extra €50. and there was no Wi-Fi. So I was literally just like lying there just, you know, watching crappy French television for a week.
Watching bad French television.
Yeah, it was bad.
Now, guys, for people who really want to stay well when they're traveling, do you have like a one great tip that you want to pass on?
Michael, what would you say?
Oh, to stay well? Well, I think a lot of people, you know, before they go on holiday, they're working really, really hard. And then they just sort of, they get away on holiday and they just collapse. They're exhausted. They're often really tired when they hop on the plane. Mm-hmm. Maybe, you know, if you're getting married or something, there should be some space between the time you get married and the time you hop on a plane, because you're going to be exhausted, you know?
Yeah, right.
Although you're typically young and fit. And
yeah, so yeah. How about you, Flip? What do you think?
Okay, again, the hand sanitizer.
Oh, yeah?
I love that stuff. Mm-hmm. But I think also about getting sick overseas is just behaving as you would almost normally at home. You know, people, part of travel is about getting out of your comfort zone and doing things that you don't do at home. But at some point you have to ask yourself, you know, licking the handrails on a cruise ship. I've got a real thing about licking stuff today, but, you know, is that a good idea? Is that something you would normally do? You know, eating from a lukewarm buffet, is that something that you would do at home? For some reason, when some people go traveling, they absolutely lose their senses of
just stop thinking,
just
entirely
being a rational person.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, just basically keep some type of reasonable sense about you, and that will always keep you in good stead when you're traveling.
Okay.
And that and a small jar of hand sanitizer.
And don't lick the top of the can.
Yeah.
Yeah, don't lick stuff.
No, mine would be to be very careful with water. I sort of have a thing about water. I only ever drink bottled water. I never brush my teeth with tap water, I have to say. That's a big one for me. And just be careful with things like salads and other fruits and vegetables that are going to be washed in local water, because they can often carry germs with them as well. I think that's
I think salads, yes.
Yeah,
salads are going to be washed in tap water. If it's not necessarily safe, then I would say stay away from salads.
Guys, thanks very much for coming along today.
Thanks,
it's been great chatting. If you would like to read more from Michael or Flip or myself, you can go to traveller.com.au. For up-to-date travel advice and information, go to smarttraveller.gov.au. And to subscribe to Flight of Fancy, go to iTunes or your favourite podcasting app. And we'll see you next time.